It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Lake Michigan water levels reached an all-time high in January, breaking a record from more than 30 years ago. We'll talk about what this means for coastal communities and the increased risk of storm damage. First, Democrats and Republicans in Wisconsin have called access to mental health care an issue that needs attention. And last year, a bipartisan task force on suicide prevention released a series of recommendations to the legislature. On Tuesday, Governor Tony Evers signed one of those recommendations to provide grants for peer-to-peer suicide prevention programs in schools. There have been disagreements, too. In last year's state budget process, the Republican-controlled legislature approved less money for mental health care in schools than the governor requested. Republicans criticized Evers in November for redirecting money meant for a mental health center in northwestern Wisconsin. We'll talk to two state lawmakers this hour about what action they want to see when it comes to mental health care in Wisconsin. Jonathan Brostoff joins us first. He's a Democrat representing the state's 19th Assembly District in Milwaukee. He sits on the Assembly's Committee on Mental Health and is part of the Speaker's Task Force on Suicide Prevention. Representative Brostoff, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, from where you're sitting in your district in the Milwaukee area, what do you see as some of the most pressing mental health needs there?
I think there's kind of two main areas of focus here, but it's actually from my travels across the state, not unique to Milwaukee or to my district. One is the need for increased capacity. We have to focus more on preventative services and make sure that places, for example, like the Grand Avenue Club and other clubhouse models are able to let folks in and have the capacity to bring people in and to kind of foster a better environment for folks who are struggling with their mental health from time to time. And we also need to work on the issue of firearm access. The two things we kind of heard over and over and over across the state were exactly what was echoed back in my district. Means matter, that firearms are a huge portion of the suicide situation in Wisconsin, and that we need to really invest in capacity for preventative measures so that we don't have as many, for example, Chapter 51s or emergency detentions or other kind of out-of-control situations. We want to get to people when we can make sure that they have, you know, they're in need of proper access to medication or therapies or peer support groups or things so that it doesn't escalate to those levels. And those are the two areas we need to focus on.
Before we dig deeper into those particular solutions, do you get a sense that people are feeling an urgency about these issues, both the constituents you talk to around the state and people in the legislature and governor's office?
Yes, absolutely.
Now, the Wisconsin Office of Children's Mental Health put out a new report this week. One of their findings said that we need 117 more psychiatrists to meet the needs for children in the state. Mm-hmm. So that gets to that capacity issue you were talking about. What do you think the state could do to fill some of those needed positions?
Absolutely. Well, one thing we could do is expand Medicaid, Badger Care here in Wisconsin, and make sure that we have more appropriate reimbursement rates. We basically have these wildly important services, but for purely political reasons and because they want to kind of oppose Barack Obama, even though he's no longer president, the extremists in control of the Republican Party right now have said we're not going to take the expansion here in Wisconsin. And that has meant a lot of suffering, but it also means that reimbursement rates aren't where they need to be. And that's something we hear over and over and over. If you can't pay people enough, it's harder to have a sustainable business model where people want to locate in Wisconsin. There are other things we could do, such as, you know, if people work here for long enough, we can take care of your tuition. And there might be other incentives. But at the end of the day, the reimbursement rates are kind of the biggest story around town that unfortunately the Republicans in charge for, you know, I think incredibly selfish and horrible political reasons have chosen not to take on.
Yesterday, as I mentioned, Governor Evers signed this bill to provide grants for peer-to-peer suicide prevention programs in schools. Mm-hmm. They got a lot of bipartisan support. You were one of the two people, I think, in the Assembly to vote against it. Why did you oppose that particular bill?
Well, as I actually was interviewed recently and kind of wrote a pretty long piece about this, I don't oppose that particular bill in specific. I voted against the whole package, and I had a floor speech explaining exactly why. But I'm all for peer-to-peer programs. In fact, I've worked and volunteered in them before I was in the legislature. I've seen it firsthand. I've bought my colleague, who's going to be joining us later, Representative Tittle, down to one in Milwaukee that I used to volunteer at called Dry Hooch for Veterans. And I strongly believe in the model. And in fact, I think we need more support. What I wasn't willing to do was allow myself to be a pawn in the game of politics here, because I don't think it's a game. We need a significant increase in capacity, a significant investment. And what we were faced with was was below the minimum level of acceptability for standards as far as investment in mental health. And what we saw was a bunch of politicians running around the state, breaking their arms, patting themselves on the back over doing the bare minimum. And I say, no, I think we should expect more of our elected officials. We are in a crisis situation. We don't need a couple thousand here, a couple thousand there. We're talking about close to 60 or 70 million of investment. And unfortunately, the people running the state right now, and people like Robin Voss and other Republicans, can find billions of dollars for extreme corporate welfare overnight. But when it comes to literally saving lives and doing what it takes to help people who are in horrible situations and situations I've been in before, you know, they can't lift a finger because it's too expensive. I don't accept that.
Well, is there a case to be made for doing some now, some in the next session, taking small wins and building from there?
So I would actually not classify it. I think the framing of that's completely backwards. I think it's a huge loss, meaning the opportunity cost of not spending the money to save the lives now and until the next cycle. Those, you know, might sound like a lot, $10 million, $20 million, $50, $60 million for investing in this sort of healthcare. But when you look at it, it's actually much better fiscally. You know, it's much better as a return on investment because you're saving people from these emergency situations, but you're also saving lives and you're saving family members and all the kind of horrific echoes throughout the community that these sorts of situations find people in. And if we're not willing to invest in that, I'm not going to take a victory lap. I'm sorry, but I'm not going to break my arm patting myself on the back, and I will not play that sort of game. That's not what I was brought here to do. I was brought here to bring attention to an incredibly serious issue, and that's what my vote was about.
Now, you mentioned, you talked about the peer-to-peer suicide prevention programs, the schools. You mentioned Dry Hooch. We've talked to some of the organizers of one of those in the state for veterans. Can you talk about that peer-to-peer model?
Absolutely. Well, it's a really smart idea that's kind of come into favor over the last 10 or 15 years in Wisconsin, but it's actually something I participated in years ago as well. And it's based off of having people with lived experience and who can understand what folks are going through and relate to them on a very kind of personal level because of their experience, working with other people who are in sometimes very desperate situations and even sometimes in crisis. And there's a, I think, just inherent level of understanding and empathy that is really helpful with a model like that. And it's also statistically proven to be very successful. Dry Hooch, as you mentioned, and I talked about before, that is a great example, but there's plenty across the state. And it's a great model. It's very effective, and we need to be serious in investing in that sort of model, and that's what I'd like to see in Wisconsin.
We've talked recently on the show about the number of people, not just in Wisconsin, around the country, who are in jails or prisons and have a mental health concerns. And you know, some of the largest mental health providers in the country are jail systems in big cities. What do you see as needs in Wisconsin when it comes to mental health and the incarceration system?
You're absolutely right. One of the biggest quote-unquote providers of and houses of people who are in need of mental health services are our jails and prisons, and that's completely inappropriate. They are not, you know, first of all, they're not set up for that, and second of all, most importantly, they're not able to provide the important and necessary treatment when someone's going through that sort of a health crisis. So, again, that actually brings us back to the original point, which is we have to build preventative care models. We have to focus on prevention, not on punishment. And we want to get to people before they reach crisis level. And that involves building capacity on the front end. And that's the thing, too, you know, just quite frankly, that really upsets me in this world of politics. When you're talking about things like corporate welfare, like the Foxconn or Fiserv or all these huge bailouts, it's like, well, if we put all this money into these corporation hands, these billionaires and millionaires, you know, maybe they'll create jobs on the back end and that'll be great for us. If we put the money into these preventative services and gave people access to healthcare, not only would they be more productive, society members and paying taxes and working and all that sort of stuff, but it's the morally right thing to do. Aside from how much you want to, it makes sense as far as purely fiscal arguments, but it also makes sense morally. And quite frankly, I think that's been the biggest failing of this whole experience for me. And one, that really kind of got to me on a personal level, if I'm being, totally frank with you.
What is it about the mental health issue that made you want to focus on a particular as a state representative?
Well, I've personally struggled a lot with, my own mental health issues and my bipolar disease, which has been something that's given me a lot of firsthand experience, but also a lot of understanding into what it's like to be in that crisis mentality, to what it's like going through suicidal ideations and actions. And I also had a very close friend who recently committed suicide, whose mom is also very close with me, that was one of my regular we would play cards together on a regular basis, and he was coming over to my house for one of our card games, and everyone else showed up and he wasn't there, and he said, "Oh, I'm not feeling too good, I don't know if I can make it," because we're all saying, "Hey, we'll see you tonight," and sending, and he was doing, and we knew he had struggles, but he was doing better at that time, and was talking about pursuing some stand-up comedy stuff. He's a very funny guy, but he made a really severe Facebook post, and someone saw it right away on their phone. We called the police, and it was too late, and he had shot himself. And I've had other situations like that, although that was one that was very recent and glaring to me. But these lived experiences as lawmakers, we're just people. I'm just a person like anyone else, and it does carry a kind of heavy weight with you as a person and as someone who wants to do better and see better. And the last thing that the last message he gave to the world was, "It's messed up that this situation, that I can get a gun with my mental health problems. It's messed up this happened to me. And I ask that someone do something about this." And, his last thing was to say, "Can someone else please do something so that this can't happen? And I don't want other people to have to suffer the way I suffered." His last thing on earth was an act of kindness to reach out to help others. And I think it's incumbent upon all of us to try and fulfill that wish.
I'm sorry for that loss of your friend. Do you hear stories like this as you go around the state talking to people?
Yeah, actually, we met with all these different organizations, with LGBTQ+ youth organizations, and with a military and cops and veterans, and with the farmers and all these. We had kind of different focuses in each of the task force led by Representative Ballweg, who did a great job with that. But pretty much across the board, we kept hearing the same sort of the through line was that, although they had very different experiences and even professions and things like that, that was the through line. Yeah.
We were talking with Democratic State Representative Jonathan Brostoff. Coming up in a few moments, Republican Paul Tittle joins us. They're both on the State Assembly's Mental Health Committee. We're talking about mental health issues in the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want lawmakers to know about mental health care needs in your part of the state? The number is 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about mental health needs, mental health access in Wisconsin. We've been hearing from Representative Jonathan Brostoff, a Democrat who stays with us in our Milwaukee studio. Now, Representative Paul Tittle, a Republican, joins us both on a key committee on these issues. Representative Tittle, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Well, good. It's good to be on the air with you, Rob.
And can you talk, we've been hearing from Representative Brostoff about some of his priorities. What do you see as some of Wisconsin's biggest needs when it comes to mental health access?
Well, there's I think one of the greatest things is a workforce shortage. We have a very large workforce shortage in the mental health field. And I've heard it for time and time again, way back when I was first serving on the Speaker's Task Force for Mental Health. We actually had meetings all across the state of Wisconsin. And when we were done, we had some bills that came out of that. And this is back in like 2013. It was just in my first term as a state representative. Then we meet with the speaker after the election in 14. And so in 15, we meet with the speaker and he says, "What committees do you want to serve on and what have you, various things." And I said, "Well, I'll be very honest with you." I said, quite frankly, our work on mental health is far from over. And a day later, he calls me up and he says, Paul, would you care about, or would you want to be chairing a committee on mental health? And I go, well, you do know I'm not a counselor, a psychologist or psychiatrist or anything like that. And he said, no, but he said, you care. And that's what we do. And I'm very thankful that Robin Voss saw that need for a mental health committee within the Wisconsin State Assembly, and I've been chairing it ever since. So I think the number one thing that we've heard beyond stigma is that there is a workforce shortage, a shortage of getting in to people that can provide the help on mental health. Unfortunately, I had a meeting just last year with a gentleman that from the Milwaukee area, from Jonathan's area, and he was telling me a story about his son had a mental health issues, and finally the son agreed to get some help, and it was months before they could get him in to get the help that he needed. And in between time, unfortunately, the young man decided to end his own life and committed suicide. And I just broke my heart, because there's people out there that need the help, and we need to get them the help now. And that's why we've crafted one of the bills that I've crafted is the income tax credit deduction for allowing you come to Wisconsin and practice psychiatry. And if you come and you practice in psychiatry in Wisconsin and get licensed as a new psychiatrist in Wisconsin, and you serve in an underserved area, you can earn up to $200,000 of income tax-free money. And if you serve in anywhere in Wisconsin, you would get up to $100,000 of income tax-free, which it's kind of like the loan repayment program for in underserved areas when you have physicians that serve in that area. And I believe that that is really... I want to attract people here to Wisconsin to help the people of Wisconsin. Now, if that means that we steal them away from Missouri or Illinois or Indiana or whatever, I'm okay with that, because my job is to help and protect the people in the state of Wisconsin. And that bill is unfortunate. Now, we've had that out a couple of different times. The biggest problem with that one is I think we get scored on a fiscal bureau. We get a fiscal memo on it on what's it going to cost. And they don't look at the dynamic scoring, which means that, helping people get the help that they need prevents them from getting into Winnebago or Mendota or whatever at like $1,100 per day at either one of them institutions. And a lot of times that comes back on our local counties. And they don't realize also that these people are not here right now. These psychiatrists are not here, so they're not paying anything in taxes right now. So it's a little frustration on my part, and because I think it would be we need to get more people here helping people in Wisconsin.
I had asked our listeners to call in with a story. Ellen joins us in Cedarburg. Ellen, hello.
Hi. Sorry. Hi, Jonathan. You were my representative while I lived in River West, and I respect your work a lot. The gentleman that just spoke, unfortunately, it's very true that it's very, very hard to find psychiatric help out here. It took me almost a year to find a new psychiatrist. But I did want to say that there was a program that I was part of that saved my life out at Cook County Mental Hospital. It was a day treatment program, and they kept me there for as long as I needed. And there was so much care and excellent care, and I do mean it when I say it saved my life and many other people who I was there with.
Ellen. And where was that, Ellen?
That Cook was County. At Milwaukee Mental Health Complex, and it was called the DBT program. It was a day treatment program, and it is no longer funded there. It was miracle working, and I hope we can do it again.
Ellen, thanks.
Was the DBT, was that dialectical behavioral therapy?
Yes.
I'm actually working, I have a group across the state I'm working on right now on that very issue and making sure we can I haven't introduced it because there's a significant amount of background work we're going to have to do because it's a relatively new practice in Wisconsin, but rest assured, we're working on it, and we're going to have something very soon that hopefully you'll be proud of and we can get back. And I agree with you. It's a great tool in the toolkit. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that story. Representative Tittle, Representative Brostoff was saying earlier, we're doing a lot of small things. He says we need a bigger, more holistic, and a bigger investment in mental health than we're doing, and we're kind of nibbling around the edges. Do you see a need for kind of a bigger across-the-board approach?
Well, I'm always for more help for people with for mental health issues. So I think we can actually do a lot of different things. We have another bill that I know Jonathan is a co-sponsor with me on. It is the Mental Health Clubhouse Bill. Mm-hmm. And what that does is that there's clubhouses, like they have one in Milwaukee. We have one in Manitowoc called Painting Pathways. It's a drop-in place where people with diagnosed mental health issues can actually go during the day. They can help them with work search. They can help them with food and navigating the system. And they're great places, and they save the taxpayers a lot of money. So we had an idea that after meeting with them, myself and Senator Lemieux from the Oostburg area, we thought, well, why they have to raise so much money because they're not funded by state money at all. And we thought if they were able to get a matching grant funding, and we've done it for a lot of different programs around the state where we could match up to $50,000, it would help them to maybe get a second person there, because basically it's run by one person in Manitowoc. I'm not sure what the Milwaukee clubhouse is. I know there's a clubhouse in Madison. These are accredited clubhouses that are not, they're not just somebody just opening up a storefront. These are accredited clubhouses with mental health professionals that can actually help people, and they just work fantastic.
And just a brief thought, we're just about out of time, Representative Brostoff.
Yes, I agree. And I will say, you know, I do not question Paul's passion on this, and we've worked together on a bunch, and I had a similar idea, and often is the case in the legislature, especially before Evers was there, if a Democrat comes up with an idea, you give your bill to a Republican to help usher it through, and I handed over my clubhouse idea to Paul for that, and he's been, you know, great as far as seeing the vision for it. We haven't been able to get it passed yet, but we do need to focus on prevention, not punishment. We should have mental health facilities in the same way of other healthcare facilities. When people can get access to liver treatment or other things, it should be treated the exact same way. Remove the stigma and not treat it in our jails and prisons, because it's not appropriate. I still don't understand how we can have so much money for extreme corporate welfare and for billionaires and millionaires. We can't give the appropriate resources to the people who need it most.
We have to jump in. We are just about out of time. A lot more we could get into. Thanks to both of our guests, Republican Paul Tittle and Democrat Jonathan Brostoff, both state lawmakers on the Assembly Committee on Mental Health. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Evers announced a special session of the legislature to look at using a budget surplus for education and property tax relief. We'll get the details coming up. First, record-high water levels for the Great Lakes region have created problems for shorelines, infrastructure, property owners, and industries that rely on those waters. This January, Lake Michigan reached record highs, with water levels averaging about 4 inches above the previous January high set in 1987. Lake Superior also broke records for high water levels in January. That's according to data from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Those record highs come just 7 years after Lake Michigan and Lake Huron were at record low levels. So what does all this fluctuation mean, and what can we do about its impact on coastal communities? Adam Beckley is a coastal engineering outreach specialist at the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. Adam, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I give a little taste of the numbers there. Give us a sense of this fairly dramatic fluctuation in our water levels in the Great Lakes.
Yeah, so you mentioned that Lake Michigan itself was at an all-time low, and it was a period of sustained lows of over a decade. And the question then was, are lows the new normal? And now we've certainly seen that that's not the case. We had quite a dramatic rise in water levels, up 5.5 feet from that record low to where we are today. And it's basin-wide. Every Great Lake set a record for at least the month it was in over the last year.
I talked to somebody from the Army Corps of Engineers a while back, and he said maybe abnormality is the new normal, these fluctuations that it sounds like we hadn't really seen before.
Yeah, I mean, the Great Lakes have always gone up and down, low to high. It's something that if we're on the Great Lakes, we have to be accustomed to. But yeah, the dramatic rise is pretty unprecedented to go from record low to record high.
Let's sit on that record high a little bit now. We've seen storms, flooding events, damage on coastal communities. What kind of effect is this high water level having on our Lake Superior and Lake Michigan shorelines?
Sure. There's a couple of effects. And so with the water levels being high, that makes it kind of a starting point for flooding and erosion to happen. So when storms come in, with strong winds, they'll push water up and cause a storm surge. They also create waves on top of that. So in low-lying areas, on top of high water levels and a storm surge and waves, that can bring a lot of water in and inundate those low-lying areas. Some of our higher-lying areas aren't immune to the problems either, because those waves can start eroding the coast. And because they have a starting point that's higher than we've almost ever seen, we can see quite rapid erosion.
If I am running a city on the shore, or if I have property, I guess with these high water levels, I might want to try to build in a way that deals with these high water levels. But in 10 years, they might be low again. Does that complicate the situation? We don't necessarily know what Lake Michigan or Lake Superior we're planning for.
Yeah, it is difficult to manage those highs and lows. But it's being cognizant that we need to be prepared for both situations. And one of the things that can be an issue is the water level cycle from low to high and do it over a period of many years. So sometimes you have never seen water levels like this before. And so it's a new thing to people who are running things, people who own property. But in terms of history, we know that highs and lows have existed.
I know you consult with communities on the shorelines and how they can plan for this kind of variation, the impacts of highs, lows, and in-betweens. What is your starting point when you're talking to somebody to say, how they can build for the next 30 years of high and low water levels?
Sure. Yeah. With this high water levels now, it's easy to look right at the water. And I like to help people take a step back and say, let's work from the top down. Where is something that we value, a home or infrastructure? And let's start looking how far away is that from the hazard, either from flooding or from erosion. Is there an issue, or is it an emergency? And I'll say up front, if there's concern, consulting with a professional like an engineer or geologist is always a good step to kind of first assess that threat and then start thinking about what to do. But starting from the top is having distance between that hazard. And sometimes that means if there's space available on a property, picking up and moving a home. That can oftentimes be the most cost-effective and cost-efficient way to stay out of harm's way.
Easier said than done, depending on where you are.
Certainly.
If you're in a crowded suburb or city, it's a little harder to find that extra space.
Yeah, yeah. It's definitely not a one-size-fits-all solution, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution on the Great Lakes. So looking at the top to bottom, then starting to look at, okay, where's water coming off my property? Because that can be, we're concerned with the water in the lake, but oftentimes water running off from our roofs, our driveways, can actually cause erosion starting from the top and compound the issue with the waves hitting at the lake. So trying to manage that water, where is it going? Pointing downspouts away from the edge of a bluff, collecting that water in a rain barrel and using it to water plants, that can a lot of times help stave off some of that compounding erosion from the top and bottom. And then as we work our way down to the water line, then if we still have an issue that property is still under threat, then there's nowhere to move it, then maybe thinking about trying to slow down the erosion starts to come into play. But that's a very expensive proposition and can have unintended consequences. So that's why I like to say start at the top and then work your way down and use that as maybe your last resort.
Talking to Adam Beckley from the UWC Grant Institute, looking at the impact of up and down levels in the Great Lakes over the years and what that means for coastal communities, coastal property owners. Let's talk about that last solution. I've seen people talk about fortifying, in effect, their shoreline to prevent erosion. And that, as you're saying, can have unintended side effects. What can that look like?
Sure. So a lot of common solution in the Great Lakes is what's called a rock revetment. And so that is using large stones that are big enough to resist the being moved by waves, angular stones that kind of lock in with each other, And that sort of slows down erosion of the coast because the rock is much more resistant to erosion than the natural shoreline. However, you're changing the character of the coast. So as waves hit those rocks, they reflect energy back into the water, makes it harder for sand to settle out. So if you put in a revetment, you're really reducing the chances that you'll ever have a beach in front of your property. And as we reflect out that wave energy, that can increase erosion at neighboring properties. So, again, it's one of those things where it's not to be taken lightly, but it's also sometimes the solution.
So it sounds like an approach like that would have to be coordinated with your neighbors, whether you're talking about I have property and two people next door to me have property, or I'm a Midwestern city and the city next door is worried about if I'm shooting the extra wave force at their beaches.
Yeah, it's always a good thing to try and work together with neighbors to kind of come up with a solution. It can be, first off, just more cost-effective to have one mobilization cost and trying to get a structure done. And then also you can kind of work together to mitigate those unintended consequences to some extent.
Now, we've been talking about erosion as one of the big risks, and that's something that can take place over time. We've seen some storm events now with these high water levels that are, you know, damaging breakwaters in southeastern Wisconsin, causing flooding and damage on Lake Superior. What can we do for those, acute events, if I could use a medical term, to prepare for those with high water levels?
Well, one thing in elevating buildings is one option to get them out of the way or moving them out of the floodplain. That water comes in with a lot of force, so it can be difficult to stop it if it's too high. I know sandbagging can be a temporary measure to some extent to help hold back water, but it's definitely not a permanent solution, and you're only protected as high as those sandbags go. So.
And I've seen concerns when infrastructure has been damaged along coastlines that, are we going to rebuild these culverts or breakwaters or whatever just like they were, when just like they were is what just got damaged? Are you seeing communities say, okay, we need to think about what we used to think the worst case was and make it a little worse of a worst case?
Definitely. And with the unknowns of where the water levels will be in the future, how they might fluctuate going forward, that complicates things a little bit. But definitely that's part of the conversation with everyone is, what are we actually going to be preparing for, and maybe think beyond what we've seen in the past.
Now, is this partly a mindset issue? Because I know if I stand on the shore of Lake Superior, it seems like this eternal, unchanging thing. But the reality, as we're talking about here, is where it is this year might be different in 5 or 10 years. Do we need to build in the first place with these fluctuations in mind?
Yeah, if you're starting from, you know, blank slate, thinking about how much erosion has occurred at this site historically and trying to locate assets, roads, houses, a sufficient distance away to have a long geo time, you know, the amount of time and years that it would take for erosion to get to you. So starting thinking that way, and also with in terms of elevation too, thinking about how high could the water go and the high water levels and a big storm, and you want a little bit of extra buffer space even beyond that. So.
And of course, a lot of places aren't blank slates. We've talked about this some. For those communities that these high water levels are higher than they were built for, and we've talked about this a little, but what are the first steps they might take now to deal with this in the future?
Well, I think it's first kind of assessing what is at risk, what assets are at risk, and at what level of either water level will they start taking damage, and trying to figure out prioritizing, okay, what is the most at risk? Maybe what coastal protection might be in the worst shape, perhaps, if shore protection needs maintenance, and try to prioritize based on that. It's not an easy task. I don't want to make it sound like
sure.
that, but finding a starting point.
Speaking of not easy tasks, is anybody out there saying they can predict what the water levels are going to do in 1 year, 3 years, whatever?
No, not out that far. The Army Corps of Engineers issues a 6-month forecast at the beginning of every month. And so those just came out for February. And Lake Michigan is definitely expected to stay high. And the center of those forecasts are above the record highs for all the months going out 6 months. So
spring and summer storm season could be kind of scary if those levels are staying up there.
Certainly, certainly.
But a lot to watch out for. Adam, thanks a lot for coming up to the studio today.
Well, thanks for having me.
That's Adam Beckley, Coastal Engineering Outreach Specialist at the University of Wisconsin Sea Grant Institute. He joined us for a look at the impact of high water levels currently in the Great Lakes and what communities can do to help prevent damage. Coming up, we'll get the latest on the Wisconsin budget surplus and what Governor Evers says he would like to do with the excess funds. That's coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up with the box office success of Crazy Rich Asians, some have said we're in the middle of a romantic comedy renaissance. We'll talk to a film scholar who says, don't call it a comeback. Romantic comedies have never gone away, but they've seen some big changes since the 1980s. First, Governor Tony Evers called on state lawmakers today to invest about $250 million in the state's public education system with a focus on special education and mental health spending, along with some property tax relief. The money would come from a projected tax surplus that's expected to be around $450 million. But Wisconsin Republicans argue the extra funds should be used mainly for a tax cut. Sean Johnson is the Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Well, tell us about this projected tax surplus. What does that mean?
Yeah, so this came out a couple weeks ago in late January. The legislature's nonpartisan budget office put out revised revenue numbers, projections, basically looking at trends that have happened in the economy since the last time they put out numbers, actual tax collections, and then trying to predict the future, essentially. And they're very good at it, but they are projections. And what they showed is that the state is expected to take in $818 million more in tax revenue than previously expected. That's going to leave the state with a balance of about $705 million if they don't do anything at the end of this current budget cycle. And that's about $450 million more than was originally projected. So when you have money in the state's general fund and it's an election year, legislators, governors, they have ideas for what to do with that money. And so that's what you've seen the last couple of weeks and what you saw today from Governor Evers.
Yeah, talk about what Governor Evers announced today. What's he looking to do?
He is looking to put the money into education. So he called a special session today to introduce this bill that would spend about $250 million more on public schools. About $130 million of that would go to the state's school aid formula and bring the state back to spending two-thirds on education, picking up two-thirds of the cost of public education. And then the package would also emphasize spending on mental health funding at schools and then also on special education, which has been a big priority of the governor's.
And the governor also mentioned a little bit of property tax relief in the mix. Is that right?
What he's saying there is that if you spend this money on, put this state aid into public schools, that there will be less pressure on, there'll be less pressure on schools to go to referenda to ask local property taxpayers to, pick up the difference. And then also just that the way that the school funding formula works, when you plow in more state aid, there's just less pressure at the local levels to increase the local levy.
Now, and you mentioned that two-thirds state commitment to school funding. This has been a long tradition policy in the state. Can you talk about where that came from?
Yeah, it used to be a law for a little while. I mean, it was something that was passed initially under former Republican Governor Tommy Thompson at a time when, the state had a lot of new revenue growth. And, they were in a position kind of like we are now where lawmakers and the governor wanted to kind of enshrine this in law, and so they did. They put a larger commitment of state dollars to school funding. That went away after the recession and subsequent budgets in the early 2000s, and it's never come back, under state law, and it's never, the state has never, stuck with that benchmark since then as a matter of law. And so Governor Evers wants to bring back the benchmark, and he wants to, as part of this special session, get back to two-thirds funding. He says this is something that Republican leaders have come out for, in support of in the past. There's actually a letter from Speaker Voss to the governor that he sent back in January of last year where he said that Assembly Republicans were supporting getting back to two-thirds funding. But You know, just based on Voss's comments today and those of other Republicans, this is not something they're enthusiastic about right now.
Yeah, talk a little more about the Republican response.
It's been, you know, not, I guess, not very warm, well, let's say, to the governor's plan. Scott Fitzgerald, the Senate Majority Leader, put out some tweets pretty quickly after the governor introduced his plan. One that stuck out was Fitzgerald said, quote, Senate Republicans have been focused since last year on using our surplus for a tax cut for hardworking families, and the governor knows that. I don't see us budging off that position. So Fitzgerald saying that's what we want to do with this surplus money. The governor knows it. We're not moving. And Speaker Voss put out a tweet, said, quote, I just met with Governor Evers yesterday, and there was no mention of this special session. The governor says he wants to work together, but it appears he's only interested in scoring points, political points. And then Voss kind of articulated this that same sentiment in brief comments to reporters, you know, a little less than an hour ago, where essentially he says, we are going to cut taxes. That's our priority. And the governor knows that.
Talking to WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson about the state's projected budget surplus for this current two-year period and what the governor and what Republicans in the legislature want to do about it. Sean, I dimly remember in our last period of divided government, Republican Governor Tommy Thompson, Democrats in the state legislature, a budget surplus. Tommy Thompson wanted a tax cut. Democrats wanted to increase some spending. They compromised by doing both. As I recall, is there a prospect to do that? Hey, we'll give you a little bit of the school spending. You give us a little bit of the tax cut.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I mean, you could argue that they did that this time around with the governor's budget and the Republican legislature. They ended up with a tax cut and with an increase in school funding. The tax cut wasn't as big as Republicans wanted. The increase in school funding wasn't as big as the governor wanted. So, I mean, you could say they have actually, despite all of their fighting, they have compromised. But this is, I'm just not sure that they're going to do that this time around. There is kind of precious little time left in the legislative session. And, you know, that is under the legislature's control. They can stick around longer if they want to, but they have said that they're not going to stick around that long. The last day that the assembly is planning to be in is February 20th. That's 2 weeks from now. So whatever they want to get done, they've got 2 weeks to do it. The Senate is going to have one more session day in February, one more in March. There is a possibility that they just don't reach an agreement in that amount of time.
I'm remembering a lot of conversations with Todd Barry, formerly of the group, formerly known as the Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance. And when there was a surplus like this, his message was rainy day fund, put it in a rainy day fund. We're going to have more recessions in the future. Set it aside. Is anybody talking about that this time around, Sean?
So because the projected surplus is actually so big, the state is going to have to make it triggers an automatic deposit of about $409 million in Wisconsin's statutory rainy day fund. You know, it's a budget stabilization fund. So they've already done that to some degree. And if they do nothing with the rest of that money, it'll be there for the next budget. So it's not like this is not like a budget bill that comes up every 2 years where they have to pass something. They could not pass anything and have Evers blame Republicans for standing in the way of school funding and Republicans blame Evers for standing in the way of the tax cuts. I mean, you could see a scenario where that happens. There could also be a mixture of both, or, you know, somebody could cave, but they don't have to do anything this time around.
And it's a tight timeline, Sean. Well, this is one where we may know the answer within a month as to what's going to happen here.
I would think so. I mean, you know, the assembly they want to get out here pretty quickly. The Senate has just two more session days, and they are actually, Assembly Republicans and Senate Republicans are caucusing privately this week to get a feel for what they want to do with this money and what kind of a tax cut that they're proposing. So, yeah, we're going to know pretty quickly how this plays out, and it's going to be dominating discussion of what's going to happen the last couple weeks of the session here in Madison.
It's an election year. That's not going to have anything to do with this, is it, Sean?
I mean, you could argue that is behind the proposals you've already seen. You know, they're keenly aware that there's an election, and what's popular, tax cuts are popular, school funding is popular, and so you've seen Evers, Republican lawmakers, kind of go to their strengths on these areas already. These are issues they're very comfortable talking about, and I think probably would be happy to talking about into the November elections.
Sean, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thanks, Rob.
That's Sean Johnson, Capitol Bureau Chief for Wisconsin Public Radio. He joins today to talk about Governor Evers' executive order calling for the legislature to use a portion of a projected surplus for public education. Republicans in the legislature are saying they'd rather see it put toward tax cuts. Tomorrow, Governor Tony Evers will be on the morning show. You can catch an interview with him at 8 a.m. And you can check out Sean's reporting on this and other issues at WPR.org/news. And if you have thoughts on what you want to see done with this projected surplus, spending it, tax cuts, rainy day fund, you name it, let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We hear a lot that our modern lifestyle is just too sedentary. We sit around too much. We don't move around enough. I can be guilty of that, but I'm trying to get better with a standing desk, occasional exercise, walking around our offices here a lot more. But I feel a little less guilty now after I heard the story of a rare European salamander that takes the sedentary lifestyle to a whole new level. In research published in the Journal of Zoology, scientists in Herzegovina observed a salamander known as the Olm, a.k.a. the Proteus. It lives in caves in the region. They observed its behavior in the wild, which turns out to be not so wild. The Olm doesn't move around a lot. In fact, over the years of the study, many of them move maybe 10 meters or so total. And those are the lively ones. As reported in New Scientist, one Olm apparently didn't move for 7 years. The most active one covered about 38 meters in 230 days. That's a very slow 40-yard dash. Clocking in at 230 days will not look good in your next athletic combine. But the Olm don't care. They don't have natural predators, apparently. They don't eat a lot. They only move around to breed every dozen years or so. And they can live to be 100 years old. So stow lots to the Olm. Nice work if you can get it. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.